This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My name is Alan Scott. This is the place where government actions come face-to-face with business decisions, online at www.bgov.com, and of course on the air right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. And the past couple of weeks have been somewhat of a roller coaster, so to speak. Lots of things happening. The furloughs continue. We're in week number two. We're looking at record numbers of people now approaching the unemployment offices in their respective states, following the rules to try to get their money back. And the question is, will they get paid? Some say yes, some say no. Looks like they may, but not until this is all over with. So what is that doing to our economy here? I turn to the one and only person I know of who could answer that question and many others. Her name is Dr. Neela Richardson. She's a senior economic analyst with Bloomberg Government. Hey, Neela.
Hi, Alan.
Lots to talk about.
Yeah, lots. Where do we start?
The thing that I think is most important to people at this point, obviously getting the government back, getting everyone back inside, but more importantly, you don't mess with people's money. I mean, that's one thing that I've always learned in management and various other places. The last thing you want to do is mess with people's money. Are these people going to get paid? Those who are working now for nothing, who are deemed essential, and those who are out right now on that forced vacation, so to speak, has the government really come to a conclusion on whether or not they're going to get that back pay?
Well, federal unemployment claims to the D.C. office actually spiked this last week because a lot of people thought they weren't getting paid. There's even some critics who say giving federal workers a paid vacation takes some of the urgency out of the budget negotiations and also is costly to the economy that we're spending money and not getting any benefit from that. So this is a big mess, and it's a big mess for the economy overall.
Yeah, everybody is on edge. I was reading recently that Capital Bike Share, as I'm sure there are these bike share programs all over the country, but Capital Bike Share experienced the largest amount of ridership last week. And I'm like, of course. Everybody's home. They got nothing to do. They're used to being out. Let's go grab a bike and ride around, which is great for them. So lots of people are happy. I must admit, I'm not a government worker, but my commute has been amazing.
Really? Maybe it's because you leave early, because my commute has been terrible. I think people are still going.
Well, you know, and I feel bad for anybody who is out of work, especially because they didn't choose to be out of work. Obviously, there are lots of ready, willing, and able people out there wanting to go back to their offices, and they're just not allowed to. The Pentagon finally said, hey, look, you guys who are civilian employees, we read the letter of the law. This doesn't apply to you. Get back in here. Get back, which is great for them. Right. Great for them. They're going to get paid. Eventually, everyone will get paid. But there's some tertiary stuff that's being impacted as a result of this.
You know, the government is not a completely nebulous entity. Mm-hmm. It provides crucial functions that are necessary for the economy to keep running. And those 800,000 federal workers are necessary to those functions. So what we're having, whether it's a week or 2 weeks, will impact the economy. The longer that the government is shut down, the more impactful that period will be. So we're hopeful that there can be some kind of compromise, whether that's a cleaned continuing resolution that will fund the government for a short period of time or some kind of compromise. But what's coming down the pike is actually scarier and darker than what's happening right now. And that is the possibility of breaching the federal debt limit. That, Alan, would be disastrous to the economy.
We are just a few days away from that breach. Give us an idea of the trickle-down effect of that happening. What are we looking at?
We're looking at a pretty serious scenario. First, we're looking at if the funds start, if Treasury loses its capacity to borrow, what that essentially means is that certain debts don't get paid.
Right.
Now, there's legislation in the House that would prioritize certain debts, like the repayment of interest on bonds, over other obligations, like payments to retirement trust funds, for example.
Right.
But at the end of the day, what the Treasury has said is an obligation is an obligation, and if it's not paid, then the U.S. government is in default. What that would necessarily bring about is a spike in interest rates that will increase payments on the interest of the debt would skyrocket, and it would be much more costly for both consumers and businesses to get loans. Interest rates would be much higher than they are now.
Which one is more important, getting the government back to work or the debt ceiling?
Well, it looks like these are tied together now. They were looked at by Congress as separate things, but they're being tied together the closer we get to this debt ceiling date,
which
the Treasury
has
told us to be October 17th. The strategy is to, for the House Republicans, is to tie some of their priorities, whether it's the Keystone Pipeline, reduction in entitlement spending, or Obamacare and defunding Obamacare, to tie those priorities to a spending bills that would open the government and a debt ceiling bill. So that's the road we are on. I think what's important to note is it's not just breaching the debt ceiling. We've already actually hit the limit.
Sure.
Treasury is exhausting all the extra measures they're taking to cover our debts now. But it's not just getting to an impasse that's the critical point. Actually, the longer we are in this prolonged debate, the worse it looks for markets, stock markets, housing markets, bonding markets. It's the debate itself that's draining the energy out of the economy slowly, but we can expect that to speed up as we get closer to the October 17th deadline.
You're listening to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, where my guest is senior economic analyst Dr. Neela Richardson, and we're talking about debt ceiling, furloughs, the state of the economy today. And I've got a question for you. Were this the president's first term, would we have come across things like this sequestration? This is now just another tick in the hat, so to speak, a tick in the book here of issues that have come up during his presidency. If this were his first term, would we be looking at this?
It did happen during his first term.
Would it be as severe? I guess that's the better question. Because now he's, you know, hey, I'm here. My team is in place. This is the letter of the law, how we're going to follow it. I've told you what we're going to do, and I'm not going to back. He doesn't have the American people now behind him saying, we just won't reelect you if that's the case. He doesn't care.
Well, I wouldn't say he doesn't care, because his economic legacy, it really falls. It succeeds or fails right here. This is his time. And if he allows this country to go into calamity, that will be remembered in history. So his legacy is definitely is part of this. He is a crucial actor here. Who gets assigned the blame is a different question. It may not be the president. It may very well be that certain segment of House Republicans who are pushing prioritizations of certain things, like defunding Obamacare over funding the government. But at the end of the day, I don't think the American people care.
Thank you. That's exactly what I was about to say. The way they can fix this is by getting that group of Republicans out of Congress, voting them out, right? Potentially.
Well, right.
Obviously not going to fix the problem in the short term.
Right. So I'm a little lost on which problem we're discussing, because
they all kind of roll into one at some point.
But there are midterm elections next year. We do have a democratic process in which the people can decide whether actually they would like to see Obamacare defunded over the long term, or whether they'd like to see these priorities take place through who they vote for.
Right.
And that process shouldn't be broken. But it's being kind of subsumed into a debt ceiling and a shutdown. And so there's multiple conflicting priorities right here. It's causing, in my opinion, Congress to take its eye off the crucial ball of funding the government and raising the debt limit. And at the end of the day, those two things have to happen.
Right.
They are not optional things for Congress to decide on.
You know, there are a lot of things that are spinoffs of what the government does. And right now they're not being funded. The government pays for a lot of things. Our national parks, you know, Yosemite is shut down. You can't get to the Washington Monument now. Panda Cam is off. Oh my gosh. I can't see the panda right now.
Pandas are very important here in Washington.
I can't see the panda. And the uproar that this causes in this town is ridiculous. But there are other areas where the government input is necessary, and one of which has to do with loans. Right now, the loan industry is almost ground to a halt. You know, and this is impacting not only commercial but residential loans as well.
That's right. The what's going on is that for a lender to make a loan, it's very important that they verify certain things.
Right.
Usually those are tax receipts and Social Security numbers. Right now the IRS and the Social Security Department are closed.
Right.
They can't be verified. So these loans are at risk in the short term because there's no verification standard. Also on the housing side, FHA does have some staff on board, but it's a very small percentage of the usual 2,000 plus workers who are there, much smaller than that. And so that pipeline of new originations is definitely slowed down. But you know what, Alan, I think those are small in scale compared to the uncertainty
sure.
that the shutdown brings to the housing market. If you're a federal worker and you were thinking of buying a house this fall, you may slow your roll on that because you've just been furloughed. And that unpredictability not only affects federal workers, but also corporations. That political uncertainty has a distinct impact on transactions.
Right.
And that's what's really scary to me as an economist as well.
The government can be shut down at the drop of a hat, apparently. Restarting it is a different story. How much of a backlog are we going to be looking at with regard to housing, with regard to Social Security, with the IRS? I saw a wonderful picture on Bloomberg.com recently of an Andy Cap looking gentleman standing out in front of the IRS in New York going, well, now what do I do? you know,
the good news is a lot of our payments like Social Security are automatic.
Mm-hmm.
So hopefully they won't be too strongly affected during the shutdown. You know, the last shutdown in 95, 96, people may forget this, but there was a blizzard. It was over the holidays. There wasn't a lot of economic activity or people around to begin with.
That kind of made it better.
This is prime time.
Yeah.
And our economy is a lot different than it was 17 years ago.
Yeah.
We have a slow economy. We have a tepid recovery. We have a lackluster job market. So any dings to the economy right now are actually vibrate through the economy. And so I think this time around it's going to be much worse. And, you know, the restart, it could be problematic, but it's better that they restart as soon as possible because the longer we're out, the worse these problems get.
This is going to cost them money, too. I would imagine there's going to be a little overtime in a lot of people's future just to catch up.
Yeah,
you know, we'll see.
I'm sure. There's been some overtime in my recent past and present trying to study these issues. You know, the most ironic thing about all the shutdown businesses, we really don't know the impact of the shutdown because all the economic numbers that we use to assess the state of the economy are currently shut down with the government closure. So once it reopens, we can get those numbers and we can see how bad it was in actuality.
That statement alone would lead me to believe that it's pretty bad. The fact that we can't even get any reporting out of it means not good news. Her name is Dr. Neela Richardson. She's a senior economic analyst with Bloomberg Government. Any final thoughts? Any words of wisdom for those who have been furloughed? Any, you know, you're a money girl. You even smell like money when you come in here.
You know, I think having been a government worker mm-hmm. myself, I think a lot of government workers are led by service. And they are rewarded by the fact that they do have influence on people's lives and on the economy. One place they don't have influence on is this process.
Right.
This is between the president and Congress, and I realize that makes it all the more frustrating.
Right.
And so I think my message is more to Congress to remember the job at hand and to get it done as quickly as possible.
I've heard over and over again as I see people being interviewed left and right, they feel as though the government worker, and I'm speaking on behalf of the government worker at this point, like gigantic pawns in a big game of chess. And they're being used hey, look, we're out of work. These guys aren't working. You need to do your job.
Let's review. The sequester led to furloughs.
Mm-hmm.
And for some government workers, that was maybe 9 days over the summer. The budget caps and the budget battles and the budget impasses over the last few years have led to no cost of living raises for several years. And that may continue. And finally, you know, when Treasury does these extraordinary measures to fund the government, they're usually basically not investing in retirement accounts. That's where the money comes from,
right,
of federal workers.
Right.
So I'm sure that as a federal worker, you're feeling pretty beat up right now.
Oh, yeah.
And blamed a lot. But it's not, this is not the responsibility of federal workers. This is a political problem. It's not at the worker level. They're just part of the process.
Saw a wonderful piece on Twitter, I guess it was a few days ago, and it was a picture of Queen Elizabeth, and the caption around it said, "Time to reclaim the colonies." Would it be better? Would it be worse in the last couple of seconds we have?
Well, there is a cute baby George now. But I'm a Democrat to stay, actually. Democratic as in the political process.
Understood. And with that, we will bid her a fond adieu. Her name is Dr. Neela Richardson, Senior Economic Analyst with Bloomberg Government. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Alan.
And frankly, by refusing to negotiate, Harry Reid and the president are putting our country on a pretty dangerous path. Listen, there's never been a president in our history that did not negotiate over the debt limit. Never. Not once. As a matter of fact, President Obama negotiated with me over the debt limit in 2011. He also negotiated with the Blue Dog Democrats to raise the debt ceiling in 2010. So the way to resolve this is to sit down and have a conversation to resolve our differences.
You're listening to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, where my guest now is Dr. Peter Brusso from the Bloomberg Government Data Team. How are you?
Fantastic, Alan. How are you today?
I'm doing well. Supreme Court back in session earlier this week, and they're talking about, among other things, campaign finance, contributions and such. What is this all about? Tell me about the case. Tell me about the limits and all that good stuff.
Sure. I feel very honored. I think this is, we've now talked about all three branches of the federal government on your show, so this is a good thing.
You are Mr. I'm Just a Bill.
My former students would love you.
There you go.
One of the issues, Alan, we have is you're limited the amount of money you can donate to candidates. In the most elections, you can give $5,200 per candidate, and that's most of my money you can give for the two-year cycle. Most Americans don't have a problem where they wind up actually maxing out to a candidate. For those that do, you have the $5,200 limit. You're also limited the overall amount of money you can give to all candidates and all committees. So right now, over 2 years, you can only give a maximum of $48,600 to all candidates. And then you can give an additional $74,600 to all political action committees. So you're looking at, you know, over $100,000 is the maximum you can give over two-year cycle. For most Americans, that doesn't bother them. They don't usually hit those limits. They don't usually hit those contributions. So they can go through and participate in the political process.
Okay. Doing the math here, how many candidates are we talking about?
You can max out to 8 candidates and have about $1,600 left to give to another candidate. So at most, you can, if you max out, probably about 9 candidates total.
So this is the case is called McCutcheon versus the Federal Election Commission. What in the world could the plaintiff possibly want out of this?
He wants to be able to give to more candidates.
Okay.
And so this man is, he's a very active businessman from down south. And he has given, he's the CEO of something called Coleman Electrical Development Corp. He's been very generous. He gave $27,000 to the Alabama Republican Party. He likes to give $1,776 contributions, 1776.
Oh, I get it.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so he's maxed out the amount of candidates he would like to give to, and he's making the argument that it's unconstitutional that he can't give to more candidates than he's already given. So he'd like to support even more candidates running for office in Congress.
So if he could, he would just give money to everybody, it sounds like, or everyone who has his ideologies, that is. How many people are we talking about? Like, how many candidates does he have on his payroll, so to speak?
In terms of, you know, he's given to basically the 10 candidates he's maxed out to those,
yeah,
with some money going here and there. And the problem is those $1,000 plate dinners add up pretty quickly. But he would like to give additional money to additional candidates. And this is not a huge problem for most Americans. It's those who donate to campaigns are a small percentage in the first place. Those who max out are an even smaller percentage. And those who want to give more are an even smaller percentage, that smaller percentage. So think about like a 1% problem, the 1% of the 1%.
Is this really Supreme Court worthy? Seriously?
Absolutely. And it comes down to the First Amendment right. So in Buckley v. Valeo, the court held that money is a vehicle for speech and allows people to communicate their political ideology. One of the great things, yesterday we got the transcript from the Supreme Court, and so it was a lot of time reading court transcripts and hearing question and answer, that we heard from the Chief Justice revolved around the incremental good of donating to 10 candidates or 11 candidates. Because, you know, if you wanted to give the max amount of money of everyone running for Congress on one political side, mm-hmm. you're talking about like $2.7 million. That's a whole lot of money.
Okay.
But you could see a situation where you're giving to candidates and you gave to a couple primary candidates and they weren't successful, and now you want to give to another general election candidate. So giving to 10 or 11 candidates the maximum $5,000 each could be a potential situation where you could see someone easily giving $60,000 but still hitting the biannual limit.
This just blows my mind that the Supreme Court is taking this up. I understand how important it is to be able to support the candidates for which you would like to see in office, which will better serve you in the future. But the average Joe Blow on the street doesn't meet any of these criteria.
Right. It's a very much an inside baseball game.
Yeah.
But what you will see is this will have a huge impact on electoral processes. Because now, if you're a large donor or a super donor, if you will, you'd be very strategic about where you give money.
Right.
This will allow more people to give more money in more races. So all of a sudden, if you're a person who really cares about the New York State congressional elections, and you're concentrating all your money to New York State candidates, you're not interested in races out in California. But now you can spread your money around, so the ability to become even more influential to give money to other areas. The other interesting thing is what this would do for super PACs, because the Supreme Court...
I was just about to ask you about PACs, where you know, obviously a super PAC, I can give a ton of money to a super PAC, and they'll spread it out over the over multiple candidates. Anybody who has the same like mindset.
Sure.
Explain.
So with super PACs, you know, the independent expenditure only committees for the lawyers listening to
sure.
our show. You can give as much money to them as you want to without
right.
limitations. But the thing is, you can't give the money directly to the candidate, and it can't support types of candidate outreach. So if I give $5,200 to a congressional candidate, they can take that money, hold a town hall, go visit, you know, Peoria, Illinois, visit Moline, Illinois, and go be able to go through and see more people, more candidates. If you're only doing super PAC money, all it's paying for is more advertising, more unidirectional communication rather than bidirectional communication.
Okay. And it's not paying salaries of people who are on the campaign and things like that, which donations can take care of.
Correct.
Understood.
So in a lot of ways, if you could actually increase the amount of money you can give directly to the candidate, it's actually more beneficial for the candidate and potentially for democracy.
Hmm. Is it?
This is why we have political scientists to argue and debate.
Is
and
it? I'm playing devil's advocate now.
I see another book chapter
you know,
coming out
is
of this.
It?
No, and this is it's a big question of how is it going to shake out.
Right.
One of the biggest things, of course, has been the limits on political parties. Because political parties can do so many of the same things that candidate committees can do. You know, building consensus, reaching out to voters, engaging in dialogue. But you're also limited to the amount of money you can give to them. If you can increase the limits on how much money you can give to political parties, they can do a better job organizing, creating a dialogue among the American people. Herbert Alexander, who is the Aristotle, if you will, of the campaign finance field within political science, he actually opposed McCain-Feingold because it put such limits on political parties, because it did away with soft money.
Dr. Peter Brusso is definitely one of the smartest people I've ever spoken to, and I think I have to disagree with him at this point. I don't know. I understand why the Supreme Court is taking it up, and I get it, but it only impacts such a small group of people, and it can redefine the democratic process.
Right.
If this changes, it's definitely something interesting to follow. Supreme Court is taking it up now. When do you think we're going to hear anything?
I would expect we'll probably hear closer towards the beginning of the year.
Yeah.
The biggest concern is this is going to impact 2014 midterm elections,
right?
Because, you know, particularly when you have the earlier primaries. Hopefully my prediction at Supreme Court case is better than my college basketball predictions. But based on the Q&A and reading the transcripts, I can see the biannual limits going out the window and 5-4 being decided that you can give as much money as you want to, you can give as many candidates as you want to, as long as you don't violate the individual candidate per election limits.
Interesting. All right. Well, we'll be tuned in, and I'm sure you'll be back to keep us up to date on exactly what happens and when it does. His name is Dr. Peter Brusso with Bloomberg Government. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Al. Have a great day.
Thanks. I'll be back next Thursday at 11 with plenty more to say about the business impact of government actions. For BGov's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, I'm Alan Scott.